Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic movie review podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell. With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick. Visit us at IHateCritics.net, EveryonesAcriticPodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle is CriticsPod. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Alexa, all your podcatchers. We will read your reviews on the air. And I do notice we've gotten a lot of more subscribers in the last week, or listens at least. So please, you know, let us know what you want us to talk about, what episodes you want me to re-release if we have some that you haven't heard, or certain movies you wanted us to talk about that we may have talked about years ago. Feel free to reach out. What's the email? critics@ihatecritics.net, I think. Email I never check. I mean, it's on my phone, but it's just a lot of Twitter stuff. But that is our email address, critics@ihatecritics.net. And I do have it. I do check it. I'm not used to there actually being any content there. So, but that could change. Now that we have more listeners, and I've mentioned it on the podcast for the first time in 3 or 4 years. Borat 2 trailer dropped right after the debate, I believe.
I think so. Why is there a Borat 2? No, I'm kidding. I don't know. I'm of two minds on this for some reason. Something about this triggers me in a way to think about how I felt about Team America and about just this other kind of nihilistic, everybody's a piece of shit kind of point of view that I have a hard time with. And I know he's not going for both sides thing, because he's clearly on one side of the political divide, which is fine. I'm probably the same one as me, but I find a lot of what he does, though, to be he really just doesn't like people, and he doesn't like hypocrisy, which is I don't either. But at the same time, it's more uncomfortable for me than it is funny. And that was the same problem that I had with the original Borat, is that a lot of it's very funny, and a lot of it is very cringy, and I don't like cringe. I don't enjoy cringing at things, and I prefer something that has a sort of a point of view that I can grab onto and hold onto, and I just don't see that here. Again, I was a fan of Borat. It's been a while, but the whole Pamela Anderson thing was it wasn't funny to me. It was terribly uncomfortable, and I see elements of that in this. I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about this. I'm not as excited as a lot of people are. I know there's a lot of people are going, oh man, I can't wait to see him humiliate Mike Pence. And it's like, Mike Pence does a pretty good job of humiliating himself on a pretty regular basis. He doesn't need Sacha Baron Cohen's help.
Yeah, a lot of it. Yeah, when you go to if you go back to the Pamela Anderson stuff, and those guys on the bus, it's just like, well, he really set them up. I mean, they said horrible things, mm-hmm. but you totally remove context and you get a bunch of fucking college kids trying to be funny, whether they believe that stuff or not, who knows? They're drunk and they're trying to be funny. And, you know, I don't know that I would have said something like that, but you could definitely get me to say something stupid when I'm drunk and in college, you know?
Yeah. And
so a lot of that, like, what you're saying, I'm with you on. At the same time, it is pretty, like, the balls of some of the things he does is entertaining to me at times. So, I mean, while I don't love it like a lot of people do, I do like it a lot. There's just things I'm like, well, that's not really fair. You should, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to really grasp on it as, like, the best piece of art of all time. But it is amazing the ability to commit to a character and put himself in pretty dangerous situations or mm-hmm. embarrassing and not, you know, it is pretty ballsy to an extent, but I don't know. I'm kind of with you. At the same time, I do think there is, like, the problem with part of our political climate is a lot of people on the left attack each other.
kidding. But that happened to me on Twitter the other day.
But I think we need to do a better job of not, like, we have a hard time of not hating the other side. We need to, they hate us, you know, the right hates the left, but we need to learn to stop hating each other for the way we view things, you know. And yes, it's okay to hate racists, I guess, but not everybody on the right is a racist, you know, even though they side with them. It's just, I don't know, it's just really complicated. And yeah. There's a way to, you know, Trump gets the coronavirus, and, you know, a lot of people are saying the right things, Biden and Obama, but then there's a lot of people wishing he would die. And, it's not okay. You know, that's not the right way to go either. Not just because he would do it. And if the tables were turned and he'd be mocking Biden right now, doesn't mean anything. You know, that's the right way to behave. You know, I don't know. And that's something that I do have a problem with on the left, that I don't mind them calling out, but I don't know. It's all complicated, and this world's falling apart.
You know, we weren't going to go here, but you mentioned something there, and I wrote a review this week of a movie called The Keeper, which I don't know if it came out or not. I thought it came out this week, and we were going to talk about it, but I don't know if it did or not.
I think it actually might be. It's just going to be
a theme that pops up, but this movie called The Keeper is about a soccer superstar from England in the 1950s who, prior to that, had fought for the Germans in World War II. And in my review, I was talking a lot about fascism and about how it's not okay. I don't care that he apologized. I don't care that he, really was very reluctant about being a soldier in the German army, at least as according to what they're saying. I find that at this time, I give no quarter to fascism or Nazism in any way. And that includes trying to a movie that tries to offer a soft, romantic, sympathetic idea of somebody who fought with the Nazis. Sorry, I don't have any sympathy there. And thus it kept me from, I couldn't find anything about this movie to enjoy. Not a thing. Because I just could not embrace the idea that we're going to release a movie right now. That in this time frame, when they're not literal Nazis rising up once again, that we're going to release a movie that's all like, hey, you know what? This one guy who fought with the Nazis, who was actually a really nice guy and then became a soccer star, which has its all sorts of problematic, because he was only embraced because he was a soccer star. If he'd been a butcher, they would have probably banned him from being a butcher. Like, but if he was a soccer star, everybody loved him. That's the only reason they embraced him. And they got all these characters in the movie who were, you know, treated as if they're the villain for asking him legitimate questions about what he did in the war, how many people he may have killed, how many of their friends may have died because of, you know, things that this guy was part of. They're asking legitimate questions about how he felt about the Holocaust and about Jews. And he's treated as if he's being victimized by members of the media or this mob of people who are not okay with a Nazi playing with their big time soccer team. And they're the villains and he's the sympathetic hero. And I'm like, no, I'm not buying that for a second. And I understand that, you know, part of our values needs to be forgiving and to be understanding. That's what we try to stand for. But I have a line, and my line is Nazi.
Now, is he, is he showing remorse in this at all, or is he?
Yeah, he apologizes, and he even marries a British girl, and they have a family, and he lost his son in an accident, which is sad and all, but still, they go into this thing about him being very regretful about having been a soldier and how he was horrified by things that he saw, but again, no quarter. And not now. Release this movie in 20 years after we've defeated the Nazis again, after we've gotten rid of them. Then you can put this movie out and we can talk about being forgiving. But at this time, to try and play that card right now is just not going to work with me. And I would hope it wouldn't work with a lot of people.
Yeah, it's just a weird time. I watched The Comey Rule, which I guess we'll just talk about these two movies early on. and it was I enjoyed it. I mean, obviously it's coming from a left perspective, but it showed why he did what he did, you know, why he released the stuff on Hillary right before the election. Again, because about back in July, he went to the Senate and said, we're not going to charge her with any crimes, or our investigation deemed it's not worth it. And then later on, the Wiener stuff popped up and they got his laptop, and there was a bunch of emails from her BlackBerry that they didn't have before. So they had to reopen the case. But the only reason he went to the Senate, he was going to do it with the district attorney, but she had ties to Clinton and she would not recuse herself from the case. So it made it really awkward. You know, there was just a lot of political movements being made, and he's trying really hard to stay apolitical and just keep the FBI as its own unit that's not influenced by either side. Mm-hmm. And there was no good option. If they don't, you know, say anything, then it looks like they're supporting the right. If they do, look, I mean, no matter what they do, they come off looking like they're supporting somebody. So they always went for the best case scenario, no matter how bad it was. And when they found the BlackBerry emails, they had to reopen the case. Otherwise, it would look like they're covering it up. And unfortunately, it was 8 days before the election or whatever. Or no, it was a little before that, but I think a couple days before the election, they announced that they found nothing. So regardless, they had to go and make a statement and say what they were doing to not try mm-hmm. to influence the election. Unfortunately, it influenced the election. And, you know, Trump did a good job of convincing everybody that, you know, Comey is not good. And, I mean, they already hate him because of Hillary and now the right. I don't know. It just, trying to make the right moves in this time is just a tough time. You're never going to be able to please everybody. I'm all for a story trying to show somebody growing. At the same time, mm-hmm. It has to be done well, and it has to, and really the right time matters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the world,
when it comes to this, yeah, when it comes to the, you know, the whole thing I was saying about Nazis, if there's a Nazi right now who would like to stop being a Nazi and, you know, just disavow everything he's been doing and saying in this day and age, just be sure that you understand that we are going to scrutinize you in a way we might not at any other time. And it's not about cancel culture or about, you know, any type of meme. It's about making sure that you're being honest about what you're doing. Maybe this guy was honest. I'm assuming he was. This is 50 something, 60, 70 years ago that this happened. He was probably being very honest about how sad he was to have been a Nazi. But at this time, to play this sympathetic Nazi card is just not right now. If you want to tell me that you were a Nazi and you're sorry about it and you're going back on everything you said, I'm open to listening to you and to welcoming the fact that you're giving that up. But at the same time, you're going to be severely scrutinized because we don't trust you and we're not going to anytime soon.
Yeah. And on top of that, look, if I made a mistake that bad and then I wake up and I realize I'm wrong, you have every right to scrutinize me for the rest of my life. I, you know, ask me that question no matter what I do, good or bad. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to grow from this situation. And then I'm never a victim at that point. Every time, right. I don't care how bad it is. You know, Mel Gibson, every time he has to answer the sugar tits thing, every time he does something. And he made that bed, he has to lie in it.
Yes. And
you're not a victim. So if that, and I haven't seen the movie, so if they're portraying him like a victim, that is where I really have the problem. I have no mm-hmm. problem if they want to show him redeeming himself, but if he's going to be a victim in this situation because of the mistakes he made in the past, I think the proper thing to do would show how, you know, I deserve to be treated this way. I made this huge mistake. You know, it's, there's a comedian out there, or a bunch of comedians are out there right now that have been accused of sexual assault. They're being booked in comedy clubs right now. And there's a bunch of female comedians coming out there just kind of, they're not saying cancel the dates, but they're saying, hey, look, this comedy club's booking this guy who's accused of sexual assault. And you go to Twitter and everybody is, the guy being accused of sexual assault is now the victim. And all these female comedians are cunts and whores and assholes and whatever you want to, all these words you want to throw at women, and not one male comedian's even involved other than the ones that are accused of rape. Everybody else just kind of staying away watching these people get attacked. And it's just a sad world we live in. If you make a mistake, you gotta, you know, Louis C.K., he can come back. If he wants to have a career, there's nothing wrong with that, but he's never a victim.
Right.
You gotta understand that. That's the... I think we're still working through that with this bullshit cancel culture world that we're not really in. There's no cancel culture right now.
Right.
It doesn't exist. So I don't know. It's just a weird time to work our way through it. And I think these two movies or miniseries, you know, it looks like The Keeper kind of missed the boat on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought the Comey rule did a good job of it. But anyway, go ahead.
the biggest failing of The Keeper, perhaps, is that portrayal that he, you know, the, where they have these scenes where he's treated as he is the victim of this. And that is perhaps why I hate this movie, is that specific fact, is that they try to make him too sympathetic. And then they go the completely other way around after his son is killed in an accident. They go this other direction where he starts saying, well, all this happened because I was a Nazi. My son was hit by a car because I'm a Nazi. It's karma. And it's like, you're going all the way around the issue here to desperately try to make this guy sympathetic to the point of portraying, you know, this thing about his son, which we don't know that's how he felt. That's entirely the invention of the film. And it's very, you know, overly sentimental and just ugly and gross. And his wife in the scene calls him out for that. This isn't your fault. This happened to both of us, blah, blah, blah. But by then it's already too late. The movie has taken it in this other direction. It's just so desperately to try and make you feel sorry for this character that I just never going to feel sorry for.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's totally unrelated to the fact that, I mean, it's almost like it shouldn't even be in the movie. You know, that's not right. Part of, I'll feel sympathy for somebody who lost their kid, and
yeah.
That's unrelated to anything else about that person, you know? I'm the kind of guy that when people were cheering outside when Osama bin Laden was killed, I mean, he needed to die, don't get me wrong, but I wouldn't want to be in Obama's situation. I don't want to end someone's life. And I certainly wouldn't be a kid on the streets having, you know, praising, you know, cheering. And, you know, I don't want Trump to die right now. I mean, really, I want him to go to jail when this is over more than anything. But I don't know. It's weird for me that people are that hateful and that, I don't know. I'm kind of going all over the place now. But it's just a weird time right now. We need to work through this in order to really get everybody back together on the same page.
This is the, not to give us too much credit here, but this is the reckoning we all need to have where we can, you know, there's no truly, you know, what right and wrong, black and white side to be on here. It's all these many gray areas about how to handle this. Now, it is absolutely wrong to attack these female comedians. That one I'll give you black and white. That is a black and white situation. You're wrong to do that.
Right.
There's so much of this other stuff this whole cancel culture thing has put us on these niggling details that people keep lingering on to try and justify how they feel so they don't end up being wrong, or they can cite an aspect of an issue where they're not entirely wrong. Like, they take it to such a degree. Well, shouldn't Louis C.K. be allowed to have a job at the very least? And no one has said that he shouldn't have a job.
No.
He can have a job, but he still has to answer for what he did.
And that's the
thing. That's not the issue.
Right.
That's what we do when we talk about cancel culture, is we bring in other issues that aren't really the actual issue.
Right. And Kevin Hart had a good documentary on Netflix about a year ago detailing what he went through when he had to quit the Oscars. And it was about how, you know, he fought and fought to apologize. And in the end, it was like, you know, this is something I said, my content, you know, I've grown since then, but he eventually, by the end of the movie, understood that it was going to follow him, and he had to accept his responsibility, and that not only was it affecting him, it was affecting the people that worked with him, and anybody who worked with him, studios, mm-hmm. employees of those studios, other actors, employees of those actors. And it was a very good message of how he got to make, you know, to understand why he needed to apologize. And I mean, I'll be honest, I was against him apologizing at first, because it was like, well, he's moved on, let's quit, you know, spending time focusing on that. And there is a gray area of what's responsible and what's not in terms of what the media does, that I would like that to be a little bit more black and white. But at the same time, you know, there's something he can do about that. And it's since gone away. You know, no one really bugs him about it anymore, because people truly believe he's truly remorseful now. And he seems to be doing fine. At the same time, you watch guys like Dave Chappelle, Whitney Cummings, people I love, comedians I love. I love Dave Chappelle. I love Whitney Cummings. But they're constantly talking about being canceled. And it's like, neither one of you are in danger of being canceled. And you're kind of making it sound like you're defending these other people that are, and you're not, or Dave Chappelle, I guess, is, but you know, they're not, but it's like, just you're adding on to this narrative that doesn't exist, so you should really stop talking about it.
Hey man, like that pisses me off so much when somebody starts talking about how canceled they are to their 3 million Twitter followers and the sold out crowd that has come to see them. Like, excuse me, what part of you has been canceled exactly?
Yeah, so Louis C.K. can't play arenas anymore. Now he's got to play small theaters. Oh my God. You know,
oh, the horror.
That's, and he's not out there saying it. It's everybody else. That, and, you know, it's just, it's something we need to work towards. And, I mean, I thought the Comey rule, that really did a good job for me. I thought the movie actually kind of sucked, or the miniseries. It was really bad storytelling, and it was definitely told from a left perspective. But I like Jeff Daniels in the role, and I like the way he was portrayed, and that's, mm-hmm. you know, where it worked for me. And I came away feeling better about, I don't know, just the way things went down, and kind of wishing we were better as people.
What about Brendan Gleeson?
Distracting. I mean, he's good in it, but at the same time, it's like, it's probably true what he did, but I don't know. None of us really know. All mm-hmm. he did was talk about the prostitutes in Russia and the Hillary tapes. And every time he talked to Comey, that's all he wanted to talk about. And they're like, well, but this other stuff's going on. You know, we just had a, you know, there was a bombing over here in this country, and, you know, Russia's attacking ours. But what about the prostitutes? You need to go out there and investigate who leaked that. And it probably happened, but it got to the point where, you know, I don't know, I wasn't there. So it's like, this is where it got a little too left for me. It was like, well, now you're just preaching to the choir and you're kind of turning me off. But he, mm-hmm. I mean, he was good, just a little on the distracting side, because he looked like Brendan Gleeson in a Trump wig. And he kept doing weird things with his lips. It wasn't Alec Baldwin parody, but it was probably as good as you could do, I guess. So that's fair. All right, we should start the show.
Oh yeah, yeah, the show.
Boys in the Band.
Yes, The Boys in the Band is a remake of a 1970 movie, 1971, it was actually done by Friedkin. William Friedkin did this back in the day, I believe. This is an updating of that to a point, from Netflix, with a huge cast. Jim Parsons from The Big Bang Theory, Matt Bomer. Now I'm losing it, of course. The guy who played Spock.
Oh, yeah.
I should know his name. Yeah, but really should know the name.
Zach
names.
Something?
What?
Is it Zach something? I don't know. I'm losing. I don't know. I can't remember his name either. It's been a while.
Not the point. This is an extraordinarily stagey presentation of a night when a guy is hosting a birthday party for his friend, Zachary Quinto. That's it.
I was right. It is Zach something.
He's hosting a birthday party for him, and there are these various complications that are taking place, where people are arriving early, and he has this he's gay, but he's, you know, it's the 70s, so not everybody is completely out as they would be. You know, there's a big part of the narrative is about how out you are and how, you know, ashamed you are of who you are. And that's a kind of an undercurrent that runs throughout the movie. This straight friend of his is from college is going to drop by unexpectedly, and that kind of throws everybody into a very kind of an odd situation on top of their own dynamics. Like, there's a couple played by Andrew Rannells and another actor whose name escapes me at this moment, who are arriving mid fight. Essentially, they've been fighting for a while and they're arriving at the party mid fight. And you've got this very out and proud character, Emery, who is a whole other story, and this black man, of course, who's got a whole bunch of identity issues going on, obviously being black in the early 1970s and being a black gay man in the early 1970s, he's got a lot to deal with, and throughout the night, the character played by Jim Parsons is going to be the one who, he goes from being just the host to being a guy who's going to drive the action in a very dramatic way. And there's a little plot point where he talks about how he's quit drinking and he's quit everything, and he's not using pot, you know, that kind of stuff. And then suddenly, when things start to get really edgy, he grabs a drink. And when he does, the entire story begins to turn from there, where he goes from being rather benign to rather aggressive and angry and pitiful. And it's a tremendous performance. Parsons really is fascinating to watch in this movie. Couldn't be further from Sheldon on The Big Bang Theory, which, again, I maintain is one of my favorite TV characters ever. I don't care how people feel about him. I love that character. I thought he brought such a richness to that, even as people felt it was a parody in many ways. I thought it was a very rich character, but here he's just so dynamic and going from being, like I said, rather benign and interesting and charismatic to being nasty and vile and sad and pitiful. And I thought that was a performance that really grabbed me. I was really invested in what he did. And then you got Matt Bomer just sort of in the background. He's the, you know, he's obviously the prettiest guy there. He's just so incredibly handsome, but he melts into the background so often and then emerges to offer just these very heartfelt moments. And then throughout the movie kind of stops for a couple of monologues here and there that allow people to, you know, kind of do what you do in a stage play, essentially, which is just tell the audience about who you are and what and why you are and what it is about you that means so much to you and what's defining you. And I enjoyed those moments as well, even as, again, I refer to them as stagey. They are stagey. This is based off of a stage play. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it. Sometimes I don't mind that very much. We'll talk about that again in another one of our later movies. But I really like this a lot more than I liked most of the Netflix movies that we've seen lately, which Netflix kind of has been really missing a lot for me lately. And aside from Enola Holmes, I had a lot of nice things to say about Enola Holmes, aside from it being incredibly long, but other movies, you know, like the Jamie Foxx movie was not great. Even the Charlize Theron was good, but not spectacular. And that's kind of been a theme for me with Netflix lately and their original movies. That one we did with Tom Holland and that one was just kind of, it was good in many ways and it was overly long and bad in many ways.
Yeah, I'm amazed we even remember to talk about that one. That was my biggest problem with the movie, it was forgettable. You're right, though.
Notice I didn't say the name.
Right. Something about the devil.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, even like, I mean, they had a couple nominated movies last year, which is good. And they were good movies, but for the most part, they are just a step below. Like the Charlize Theron movie would have just been an okay action movie, and I would have probably seen it in the theater. But it's not, you know, Mad Max Fury Road. You know, it's not. They have yet to really be great. Just kind of good.
Yeah.
I mean, even The Irishman is just, it's good. You know, it's hard to say it's great. And they did that Scarlett Johansson Adam Driver movie, right?
The Marriage Story, which is probably the best movie they've ever made.
Yeah, that's different. but that's the exception. But that, you know, they're still young, so it's it's nice to see them trying, and I'm glad they are getting more original movies. We'll be watching one next week. I can't wait for.
What?
I'm kidding. I just can't wait for you to watch it. You'll pull the knee.
I thought you were going to mention Fincher's movie coming out later this month.
No, I meant the Adam Sandler movie. Sorry. No, I almost watched this. Then I watched the trailer, and I was distracted by Jim Parsons and Zachary Quinto, and I recognized all the guys, and I was just like, wasn't in the mood for it, and that's when I ended up watching The Comey Rule. In hindsight, listening to you talk about it, I let my, you know, I saw Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory when I was watching the trailer, and that's on me. I wish I would have given it another shot because I was distracted by the guys, you know, the Spock. It's, you know, these guys, that's how I know them. And I'm not letting them be another actor based on the trailer. So I think I would have liked this. It sounded very good, and hopefully I get a chance to go back and rewatch it. I'm kind of bummed I didn't.
I recommend it. Like it goes places that I thought were a little unexpected at times, and I really appreciated that. They play this game about after the midpoint of the movie that really goes to a place that is very emotional, and I was really riveted by that.
Once Upon a River.
Once Upon a River. Boy, do you want to talk about a sad, sad movie? This is a sad movie. Now, I believe this girl who's leading the movie, she's obviously, I think she's of age, but in the movie, I believe she's supposed to be 15. So this 15-year-old girl, these are the things that we're going to come to learn about her. She, her mom left. Her father was an alcoholic who's now recovered and is getting better and has taught her to fish and to hunt, and she's become very, very proficient and very good at that, to the point where she could probably survive in the woods by herself, which is, you know, an interesting aspect of a young teenage female personality. But what's eventually going to happen is this massive tragedy that's going to put her on the road to trying to find where her mother went, and the whole can of worms that's going to be. But along the way, it's precipitated by her being essentially sexually assaulted, although she's not necessarily saying no, by a man that she has referred to as her Uncle Cal. He's not a real uncle, but that's how close they are. And he sexually assaults her. And that leads to another tragedy. And then that's the tragedy that leads her out onto the river on this boat. And then she goes off into the world and she has all these other encounters, each one finding a new level of despair and sadness that are portrayed as certainly about, you know, they're growing pains, sure. But at the same time, they're also just a horrific series of events, almost Jobian, happening to a 15-year-old girl. And as much as I appreciate a lot of this movie, in terms of how well it's made, this is from a director by the name of Hanula Rose, who's directing her first film here, and she does a terrific job on a technical level of presenting all this, but I couldn't get over the fact that I was watching this happen to a 15-year-old girl. And I would imagine it would be impossible to survive what this girl survives from an emotional trauma standpoint and come out of this in any way normal. And the movie ends on this incredibly ambiguous note where she seems happy, but you have absolutely no idea what she's going to do. None whatsoever. You're not left with any sense of how this now 15-year-old girl who's gone through the experiences of a 60-year-old at this point, what she's going to do now. And I guess that's a bold way to do it, but at the same time, this movie is just so despairing and so desperately sad that I can't recommend it, no matter how much I appreciate the acting, the presentation. John Ashton is a character in this movie, and he's a character actor I've seen before, but I couldn't tell you what it is. He's got one of those faces. But yeah, he's incredible in this movie. He plays a character named Smoke, who's a former musician who has emphysema, who takes this girl in out of nowhere. They don't know each other at all. And he takes her in, and they have this lovely, you know, back and forth friendship. And it's great, but I can't get into it because there's an aspect of that even is just desperately sad. And he sings the saddest song in the world in the movie. And I mean, everything is just dire and sad. And I can't recommend it.
Yeah. I mean, you're making me want to see it. But here's why, though. And it's like, we make jokes about, you know, the way I like things, but
right,
what you just described, though, I mean, that ending is how you have to end it. You know, it's that if this happened in real life, which I guess, is it a true story, you said?
I don't think I don't know that this is a true story.
Let's just say it, if there was a true story like this, or any part of this movie that's true, or if someone goes through a rape or a sexual assault, that, you know, we're not able to put ourselves in that situation. We've never been in it. And when you throw that, now here's the ending, and I'm not saying watching this movie is the equivalent of being raped. That's not what I'm getting at.
But no, no.
It gets, when you have that ambiguous ending, this is hopelessness. How am I supposed to feel? What am I supposed to do? And you know, with anything, with, you know, a death, with any situation that's really, really bad, there's just this, you don't know how to react, and you feel like you're being watched, and I appreciate the idea. I mean, I haven't seen the movie because I couldn't find it, but I appreciate the idea of what it's trying to do, and it sounds really powerful and, you know, sad and depressing, and but at the same time, I like that real world approach. That tends to work for me, and I don't mind when a movie pulls those things out of me. It's not entertaining, but I do like when my emotions right. are moved in a direction they want me to.
I would say though that even though I recognize how sad everything in this movie is, I don't necessarily felt like I felt it so much because it was just so unending. Like the whole every new scene seems to introduce a new traumatic event. I mean, and it's uncomfortable. And I guess I can credit her for this, is that she's forcing us into a very uncomfortable place where yes, technically from a legal standpoint, anytime a 15-year-old has sex, it is sexual assault. It is, they cannot, you're at 15, you cannot give consent.
Right.
But she has two sexual encounters in this movie. Both of which she completely consents to. And that is a very awkward presentation because it puts us in a position of, I'm not judging her. I don't want to judge her, but she's not presenting as a victim. And so you have to deal with your feelings on this, which is a very, again, I credit the movie for being very bold in that way, but everything is just so dire beyond that. I'm holding back a lot because I don't want to spoil
right.
those who might find something to enjoy about this, but I couldn't enjoy hardly anything about this really, because I just kept getting overwhelmed with how any one person could go through this level of trauma because I guess maybe I've not read the Book of Job enough. I don't know.
And I'm basing my reaction on what you're saying. So I haven't seen yeah. the movie either. So you're doing a good job of selling it.
I would love to get other people's opinions on this movie. Absolutely.
I will try to see it when it becomes available for me. I'll keep an eye out for it. But I have that yeah. list of movies is growing as
as I continue to screw up what the release dates are.
Well, it's not so much your fault. It's they'll come out on a Friday and there'll be seven movies to get through. And I got to pick two or three. And I'll be like, oh, I picked the wrong one. Or Netflix had one that didn't look that good. Turns out it was really good. I should have watched it. So that's, you know, but this one I'll definitely star, and I'll let you know if I have other opinions or whatever.
All right.
Eternal Beauty.
And this is another movie. And this is, again, kind of a movie that throws a light on that one, and that it presents a story that is essentially kind of sad, but does so in a way that leaves room to breathe as opposed to being entirely oppressive. This stars Sally Hawkins as a woman who has schizophrenia and a rather severe form of it. She's on medication. She's living alone on disability and in England, because in America, you know, this person would be homeless, because that's the kind of country we are. But in England, they take care of people. And so she has a home, and she's got her medications taken care of. And as long as she takes her meds, she's good. But at a certain point, something happens that makes her throw her medication away. And this throws the world into a different perspective. She starts to have these weird little adventures. And the colors change at this point. And she's seeing life in a very different way. And she meets a guy played by David Thewlis, who's a musician, who's very weird and exciting and fun. And she has her first sexual encounter during this time. And she has... just all these little tiny adventures that make sense to her, but are terrifying to everybody else, because she's making a lot of weird, uncomfortable decisions that one might make when they're supposed to be on medication and they're not. And the movie isn't completely non-judgmental of her. There are characters who are kind of judgmental, but it's also their fault in many ways, the things that she decides to do, that she decides to go to extremes because they're being who they are. And that especially is true of her sister, Nicola, played by Billie Piper, who's just a really awful person. She's just nasty and mean, and she does mean things when people aren't paying attention to her. She's not a terrible character. She's not an awful character. But she's just this kind of – she's just a character who does mean things occasionally. And those mean things lead to things happening. And I appreciate the kind of – the allowing somebody to be happy while also being schizophrenic is something that maybe a lot of movies don't present. And Sally Hawkins gives that a very unique perspective. She's gives this character opportunities to be joyful. She gives her opportunities to be deeply anxious and frightened. And she portrays, you know, the poor decision making quite reasonably, quite fairly from how a schizophrenic person might see this. And it's a really thoughtful performance. I really enjoyed her performance. She's one of the best actresses working today. And overall, yeah, I recommend this movie highly. I think it's very well made.
Awesome. A Call to Spy.
A Call to Spy, directed by or written by Sarah Megan Thomas, who's also the star of the film, tells the story of British spies in World War II, female spies in World War II. They were kind of a unique thing that weren't supposed to happen, and then they did. They're having trouble with male spies continuously getting caught, and they thought, well, what about a woman? Stanna Katic plays a character who brings that idea forward, who says, you know, if we send a woman over there, they're probably not going to suspect them because they don't respect women. and she's right, they don't. and through that, these female spies got to be a little bit more effective than many of your male spies. They were unsuspecting, and that was the best quality about them. And they were able to pull off a lot of very important victories in terms of cracking codes and stealing secrets. And that's the story we're playing out here. And it's very well made. It's also very much of a World War II movie. Everything is gray and brown and the color palette of a typical World War II movie. And everything feels like that, you know, the period, time, places, all it's good and everything, but you don't ever feel like you haven't seen this before, even as it is coming from the perspective of female spies. It's basically just a gender flip from everything else you've ever seen of British spy movies of World War II spy movies. So aspects of this work, like, it's not poorly made at all. The performances are all quite good, but there's a quality to it that's just so incredibly familiar. I'm so tired of World War II movies. Just because I get tired of that gray, green, brown aesthetic of World War II. I find it tiresome.
Yeah. Give me the Vietnam movies back. No, I know what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, all these movies this week makes me want to go back on my soapbox like I did earlier in the movie, but I'll do my best to not. I'm going to do it anyway. Here's the thing. We had a lot of movies with female leads or female directors. He had the first movie had to deal with homosexuality. These people, actors, actresses, people in general, whenever they're interviewed, that follows them. They get asked about being a woman. They get asked about being gay. That's in every interview they ever have to do. So what's a big deal about asking a former Nazi what it was like being a Nazi? You know, that's I don't know. That's all I could think about almost the entire first half of the podcast. So I apologize, but that's what I wanted to say, and I'll move on.
quite reasonable. Quite reasonable.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed classic.
The Last Picture Show.
The Last Picture Show from 1971, directed by Peter Bogdanovich and starring Jeff Bridges, Timothy Bottoms, and Sybil Shepherd, living in this small town in Texas where there's pretty much nothing else to do but either try to have sex or have sex. That's all there is. There's no other thing in this town.
I love this movie.
And so the various iterations of that play out throughout the movie, of guys trying to have sex, women kind of not wanting to, and then wanting to. And, you know, it's interesting for a movie from 1971 to be allowed to portray women as wanting to have sex, which is nice. There was a time in our country where that was not allowed. And this movie is a very, very ahead of its time in that way. Sybil Shepherd's character specifically is pursuing, at a certain point, pursuing having sex very specifically. And it's not because she loves it, it's because of her perception of it and perception of herself, which again is another interesting way to play sexuality in a movie. And I really did appreciate that. And there's an aspect of identity and sexuality in this movie that I find to be the most appealing aspect of it as a classic is that it is way ahead of its time in dealing with characters who are defining themselves by sex or through sexual expression, but not in a violent or angry sense, which we so often get as well. So there's no violence or anger. Nobody's raping anybody, but everybody's kind of just trying to feel each other out and figure out who they are. And oftentimes that expression happens through sexuality. And it is a bold way to make a movie. And that's what makes this movie so interesting and ahead of its time, is that it allowed these characters to explore that space in a way that makes sense for them. Because again, we go back to, what else is there to do? There's a movie theater, there's a coffee shop, and a pool hall. That's it. That's the town.
Yeah, I absolutely love this movie. It reminded me of a couple of years ago, there's a movie called Everybody Wants Some. I don't know why I related to this so much. It was just fun to, there wasn't really a story. You know, you were just, it was all these characters finding their identity. And that movie was similar. It just kind of had just a time frame. Stuff happened in this time frame and then the movie ended. And sometimes I hate those movies, but this is one I just absolutely loved. And it's funny. It's a movie that's so ahead of its time, yet it was made in black and white in 1971, about the 50s. So,
yeah.
You're 100% right. It is such a weird thing about the movie, and it's so entertaining. I don't know why. I was so fascinated by every character at every time in this movie. Everything they went through, every situation. I mean, the star of the movie is the least successful actor that came out of this, Timothy Bottoms or whatever. But I don't know.
That's my Bush. Yeah.
Oh, that's who he is. Oh, wow.
That's who he is.
Nobody knows that reference because that's even old now. Oh, man. But I don't know. It was, I loved everything about this movie. Watching them go through, I mean, I could just, and it didn't bring me back to being a teenager. It was like it is really timeless. It's not just about teenagers. I mean, I really wish the sequel was available to watch because I wanted to see how these characters go into adulthood. And I watched the trailer, and it looks like not a whole lot has changed other than certain guys stayed. And I don't know. I just go watch this movie right away. If you're, I don't even know who should watch. I think everybody should watch it. It's that good and that entertaining. And any movie that can make you get attached to characters like this and really put yourself in their situations, like even I'm putting myself on the diving board with Sybil Shepherd, and the excitement that she goes, the fear to excitement, you know, you felt all of that, you know, in her performance there. I don't know. It was just such a, I mean, I'm just repeating myself saying it was so awesome. Right. It's such a good movie. I love it.
That scene is incredibly, incredibly real. Like that is that feels like a very teenage moment where everybody's very anticipatory and they go, and he goes quiet in the scene. Like there was a record player playing and somebody turned the record player off and it's just her on the diving board with an audience expected to take off her clothes. And it is incredibly awkward, mostly because all these confident young men don't know what to do when this is actually happening. Like right. They'd be okay maybe if they were jeering her and trying to push her into this, but they're really not sure what to do here as she's actually going ahead with the thing that they want her to do. And that is a fascinating dynamic. And then they're all happy when she does it, and she's one of them, and it's never portrayed as a dangerous situation where she's going to be sexually assaulted, because I don't think any of these guys would know what to do if they even tried that. And that, again, adds another almost innocent aspect to it, even as there is so many dicks in this scene.
Yeah, and then, I mean, there's a kid in the pool, so I don't even know how old he was, but that was a little awkward. But it was just that scene, the Jeff Bridges character and his, you know, he's the popular guy. He's the, you know, everything about him is kind of the guy you wanted to be. You know, he was the guy you projected on in high school or whatever. And then, but you get to see him in, you know, in his moments of insecurity, that are really powerful. You know, the guy that you're supposed to be is, you know, that's by Bush. That's kind of the guy you're really following this whole movie.
Yeah.
And he's so likable no matter, but he just does so many dumb, weird things. I don't know.
But it's very much a, you know, an 18-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Who doesn't know who he is and doesn't know what to do. And he starts having this affair with this much older woman. And even that doesn't necessarily give him an identity. It doesn't necessarily help him figure out who he is.
Yeah. And I mean, you're following him knowing you'd make the same decisions he made all the way around from the beginning to end. And
really, you know what's funny is if you really put this movie through the ringer, this is like an art house American Pie.
Oh no, for sure. This is the best version of American Pie that there is, far and away. I mean, every generation has it, but this one, it is so weird that, I mean, 71, yes, it was that long ago, like not quite 50 years ago, but it's still, you know, The Godfather was like the next year. The Exorcist was nearby. You know, their movies are starting to look more up to date than this is. Mm-hmm. And, but it is such a weird, like, I really believe anybody our age could watch this and be like, this is phenomenal. No one's going to be distracted by the black and white and the grainy footage. And they're going to look at it and be like, this is amazing. This, you know, they might not watch it because of the way it looks in the trailer, but mm-hmm. if they watch the movie, they're going to love it.
It's relevant and timeless in its presentation.
Yeah, and even as adults, you still like look back to those years. Yeah, you think of the stupid things you did, but you look back at the innocence of it, and there's a you know, we all miss that, you know. And this movie does really bring it back, and I love it. It's definitely my favorite American Pie.
Speaking of which, there's an American Pie movie next week, by the way.
Is it really?
I forgot to mention American Pie Girls Rules, which I've already posted a review of on our Facebook page. I was apparently way ahead of time on it, but yeah, it comes out next Tuesday.
Okay, I'll add it to the show.
Weird to mention it right now, I know.
All right. And then the 1990, the reason we made Last Picture Show the classic was because Texasville came out. And after, I literally watched this right after we recorded the podcast last week and was blown away by how much I loved it. And, I mean, I don't know what won the Oscar in 1971, but I'm ready to give it to this. That's how much I enjoyed it. Wanted to see Texasville so bad. I'm looking everywhere. Torrents. I don't care. I don't even know how to do a torrent anymore. I mean, it's 2020 there. Now they just have cracked fire sticks or whatever. I don't have any of that. I always pay for my shit. So I'm not even good at that. I can't find it. I'm looking for YouTube. I'm trying to find clips. I'm watching Roger Ebert's review. I'm just anything I can find on it. And I could not find this movie anywhere. So I'm really bummed and I want to see it so bad. But it looks like a different tone.
I read what Ebert wrote about it, and I watched a bunch of clips and trailers of it, and you get a sense of where these characters went to after the movie, but you don't get a good enough sense to know exactly what the movie is about. It seems like there's a lot more Jeff Bridges and a lot less of Timothy Bottoms in the sequel.
Yeah, it seems like it centers around Bridges and Cybill Shepherd with a little bit of Annie Potts. and it looks fun. I mean, I think you're going to see how immature adults really are. I mean, but I want to see it really bad because of how great Last Picture Show was. And it's still Peter Bogdanovich directing it. So,
mm-hmm. And Larry McMurtry as well, who wrote the book
right.
that it was based on.
So as soon as I have a chance to see it, I'm going to try. But I feel like it never got past DVD. Which means it's probably harder. Sometimes when it doesn't get past DVD, it doesn't get a streaming release. So I'm going to keep looking, though, because God damn it, I want to know.
I'm trying to find the Academy Awards for that year. Ah, here we are. It was nominated for Best Picture. Went up against Nicholas and Alexandra, Fiddler on the Roof, A Clockwork Orange, and the winner of Best Picture that year, The French Connection. So yeah, fuck the French Connection.
Yeah, I'm going Last Picture Show.
Absolutely.
I'll go French Connection 2. I mean, I've only seen three of them. So I guess Clockwork Orange gets the third seat. I mean, Clockwork Orange is one of those movies, again, I like to put off to the side. It's hard to compare to other movies. It's hard to even know if you like it or not. It's just so weird. Someday that'll be a classic. We're kind of avoiding it because it's really long and it's conflicting. It's just a hard movie to watch.
On the bright side, Ben Johnson, and I wanted to get to this, Ben Johnson, who played Sam the Lion, won Best Supporting Actor for that role and deserved it for just that one scene. They're sitting by a lake talking, and he's describing this relationship that from his past that with the one woman he's truly ever loved. And Bogdanovich does this fascinating thing where he's out, he pushes in. He then pulls out. You think the story's over, but the story's not done, and he keeps telling the story. And then he pushes back in, and you expect a pull out at that point when it's done, and it doesn't happen. And that's such a unique piece of direction in that moment. It defies a lot of what you know about typical ways of shooting a movie, and I just adore that moment. But it's also this incredibly, I was talking about stagey before, this is definitely a stage moment where you've got a stage actor delivering a monologue directly to camera. Not so much that he's not looking at the camera, but just that it's just the camera and him. And he's talking. He's telling Timothy Bottoms the story. And it's this deeply romantic, wonderful, beautiful, tragic story that, you know, that is just so beautifully told. And later on, when Ellen Burstyn pays off mm-hmm. that moment, it's so good. You already know.
Oh, yeah.
And you kind of sense it's going to be her, and then you realize it is her, and it's just, oh, wow.
yeah, absolutely an amazing, two amazing scenes right there. The whole movie is just so great. I can't
recommend it highly enough. Did not get a Best Screenplay nomination. Give me a break.
Well, think of how many movies. Like you mentioned it's, you know, American Pie only more artistic. But so many movies came out, you know, whether they know it or not, you know, like Varsity Blues and Friday Night Lights and all these football movies that, you know, all the sex comedies, all of these movies, you know, Porky's, all of it come from this. Mm. And none of those are even close to as good as this. But I, for whatever reason, I grab onto those movies because they made me feel a certain way. I know they're not good, but they're just fun for me because they're more of the fantasy of what high school was or what I wanted high school to be, but this one just captures it perfectly, and it's about the 1950s. it's so weird but so great, and I'm gonna definitely be watching this over and over again the rest of my life.
And Cloris Leachman won Best Supporting Actress, by the way.
Oh, good.
She's quite incredible.
Yeah, and Randy Quaid's in it.
At least he plays the fool, which is one perfect casting.
His best performance by far. What else came out in 1990 was Miller's Crossing by the Coen Brothers.
Yes, Miller's Crossing, another Coen Brothers classic. This one stars Gabriel Byrne as Tom Regan. He is a gangster in some unknown part of America where they've got Albert Finney as the top guy running an entire town. You know, he as the mayor and the police chief sitting in his office and he's telling them what to do, that kind of thing. And Tom is his, you know, right-hand man who's whispering in his ear, telling him, what moves to trust, moves don't make. And they develop this rift over this woman played by, I forgot her name now, but...
Oh my God.
Yeah.
What's her name? Gay Harden.
Marcia Gay Harden. Thank you. Verna. They have this big divide over her. And I don't want to spoil anything about those relationships, but they're complicated and wonderfully so in a sort of a classically Coen Brothers serious movie way. This is a gangster movie with a good deal of violence, but also kind of a tone that is almost darkly comic at times. Mm-hmm. And Gabriel Byrne is incredible at playing this guy who only says exactly what he has to say and does the thing. And he's manipulating the entire time and only really doing this high level chess that nobody else is playing. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but oftentimes it does work. And it's because he's so under control all the time. And there, you know, there's characters that always compliment him on his keeping his cards close to the vest, or keeping it under his hat, if you will, which is a big plot point throughout the movie, is this just this visual notion of his hat and what his hat means to him. And I kept thinking of that, you know, keep it under your hat. That statement, that's kind of what Tom does throughout the entire movie. That's his ethic. And he's always keeping things from people and making his moves behind the scenes. And we're behind the scenes with him, so we see him making those moves that nobody else sees. And it's just fascinating to watch in classically Coen Brothers fashion. And then, of course, then you have all these colorful performances going on around him, from Albert Finney, who proves to be, you know, this kind of secret badass character, even as he is being pushed, manipulated by a woman throughout the entire movie, whether he realizes it or not, which is happening in the background. You're not seeing that, but it's happening. And then you've got, you know, John Turturro giving a classically John Turturro performance. Little Steve Buscemi in there, but John Polito is the one who deserved an Academy Award for this because his character is so completely, I mean, deranged and over the top and wonderful. Just can't take your eyes off him. He gets these big monologue moments talking about ethics and the hi-hat and all these various little vocal things that he comes up with, his word salads that he does. Just wonderful. What an amazing performance. It's almost comical at times and yet controlled.
Yeah.
And I just loved it. I love this movie.
I do too. It's kind of a forgotten Coen Brothers movie by the regular audience, but in a lot of ways, this and the Big Lebowski's, more so this, like, tie every Coen Brother movie together because it has that comedic tone that, you know, something like No Country for Old Men or Blood Simple don't have, but it's got that seriousness that, you know, or that goofiness that, like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou or Burn After Reading have. It's got all of that just kind of combined into one. And it's just such a fun movie to watch. And when you think back to 1990 and kind of putting these 4 weeks in a row, I guess we didn't talk about State of Grace, which was 4 weeks ago, but then it was Goodfellas, and then there was Kings of New York, and then this, four different mob movies that are totally different toned, with The Godfather 3 coming out later in the year. you just kind of see the future of film really taking off here, especially with what Scorsese did from the old school and what the Coen brothers are bringing to the new school. And it's just really kind of neat and how it all came out of mob movies. But this is a fun movie to watch. It's kind of a dumb name, and that's probably why it took me a while to get to it. I have yet to not like a Coen Brother movie, and I think I've seen them all at this point, but this was the one I thought I wouldn't like, and I watched it. It was just so, I've seen it before this week, but it's just so entertaining and so much fun and so smart. Everything matters. You know, one little thing goes wrong and the whole movie falls apart, and Gabriel Byrne does a great job of carrying it. The Coen Brothers are just, you know, pull the best out of everybody. You said classic John Turturro performance, but really it's a classic John Turturro Coen Brother performance. You got to get him out of the Coen Brothers. He kind of sucks.
It's true.
So, but it's just, I don't know. If you haven't seen it and you're a Coen Brothers fan, right away, go get it. It's great. Anything else on Miller's Crossing?
No, not really. I don't think I have much else to say about it. I can't. There's one thing. Did you notice Albert Finney's secret cameo in the movie?
No.
So there's a story that goes that the bathroom scene where Gabriel Byrne walks into the ladies' room at the club and he's going to confront Verna and he's throwing all the women out of there and he's going to have this big confrontation for it. That was the final day of shooting in New Orleans. And Albert Finney was enjoying New Orleans so much that he just didn't want to go home. So he's hanging out, and they decided to give him a secret role. So they dressed him up as a maid, as the bathroom attendant, female bathroom attendant. And when you actually do see his face, if you look closely, there's a woman who stands up and rather aggressively does the sign of the cross and walks out. That's Albert Finney.
That's hilarious. It's so Coen Brothers too. Yeah. Great movie. A lot of fun. I mean, I had a great Sunday. It was Last Picture Show, then this, and then, then nothing else the rest of the week. Did you watch anything else from 1990?
I didn't. I forgot everything else that came out.
Everything else that came out was Avalon, Basket Case 2, Mark for Death, Henry and June in Desperate Hours. There's a Barry Levinson and a Michael Cimino movie in there.
I have seen Henry and June years ago, and that one is a pretty, pretty great movie.
And Mark for Death is a Steven Seagal movie. And I'm sure Desperate Hours is desperately long. I haven't seen it, but knowing the director. Anyway, next week we got the 40-year-old version. Hubie Halloween, Totally Under Control, Possessors, The Cage Fighter, Daddy's Girl, The Planters, and American Pie, Girls Rule. Our classic is going to be Scanners, the Cronenberg classic, because his son directed The Possessors. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then in 1990, the classic Troll 2, Memphis Belle, Mr. Destiny, To Sleep With Anger, and Welcome Home, Roxy Carmichael. So a lot of movies, but could be a pretty fun show.
Indeed.
It's all over the place. Adam Sandler, American Pie, Coronavirus, Cronenberg. All right. Anyway, if you want to be a Patreon supporter, patreon.com/criticspod is the best way to help support the podcast. And then don't forget our TeePublic page at ihatecritics.net. Anything else before we head to Flickchart?
No, nothing I can think of.
All right. We'll keep it somewhat short since we got started late and we're running slightly long, but we'll go Sunshine Tootsie.
Sunshine. I hate Tootsie. I hate Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, I'm just, it's really, yeah, he's really bummed me out lately. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Double Jeopardy.
Hitchhiker's Guide.
True Romance, I Love You, Man.
I Love You, Man, but True Romance is a better movie.
Yeah. Let's see, Star Wars or Godzilla, 1998.
Star Wars.
Agreed, unfortunately. Diamonds Are Forever, Highlander.
Highlander's funnier.
Child's Play, Thank You for Smoking.
Thank You for Smoking.
That's fair enough. Highlander being funnier is better. That's good enough for me. Godzilla, 1998, for whatever reason. Blade Runner, 1982.
Blade Runner, obviously, but why is that one coming
out? I don't know. The Boondock Saints, Don't Look Now, 1970.
Any other movie that isn't Boondock Saints.
Okay. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, The Breakup.
Lock, Stock.
Agreed. Something's Got to Give, Man on Fire. Oh, man.
Something's Got to Give. I can picture Josh's face in my head.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'll go with you. Just because Jack Nicholson's in it, it should be. Oh, shit, that's not fair. Denzel's awesome. I just watched Game Night yesterday with my dad.
Love that movie.
Just the whole Denzel stuff. The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, Mary Poppins.
Which Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? The
Fincher one.
They're both okay. What was the other one?
Mary Poppins.
I like Mary Poppins a lot. That's a weird comparison. Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Yeah. Probably one of the weakest Finchers, but still.
I think it's only weak because it doesn't need to exist. You know.
Yeah, the first one was enough.
And it was
the original.
Yeah, it's good. The actress is fairly known. She does a lot of movies still.
Mm-hmm.
Nonstop, All the President's Men.
All the President's Men.
The Full Monty, The Karate Kid.
That's tough. I had a lot of nostalgia for The Karate Kid, but The Full Monty is not a bad movie. I probably would like it if I watched it again, but it's been a long time. I'll go Karate Kid just because I watched Cobra Kai.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at, too. Big Hero 6, The Net.
Big Hero 6.
Agreed.
Very good, very forgotten movie.
Yes. Batman, Cinderella Man.
Which Batman?
89, sorry.
Batman.
I don't know. Black Swan, Double Jeopardy.
Black Swan.
Agreed. Pacific Rim, Cowboy Bebop, the movie. That's not a that's anime.
Let's no, I don't know.
Yeah. Pacific Rim, Mission Impossible 3.
I like Mission Impossible 3.
I'm going to go Pacific Rim because I thought it was impressive to make a really bad idea that decent. But Mission Impossible 3 won the coin flip. 12 Years a Slave, Man on the Moon.
Man on the Moon.
Agreed. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, 1990, Jumanji, 1995.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Agreed.
The star of this year's podcast.
The Dark Knight Rises, the creation of this podcast, versus Rocky, 1976.